Welcome to the Regional Roundup. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. This hour, it's a look at the controversy over ATVs, dirt bikes, and the groups of young men who ride through Philly. Is an ATV park the answer to questions of public safety? We'll hear from community activist John Dye Harrell. And the Philadelphia Orchestra's fall season opens this week. Orchestra President Matthias Tronopolsky and Concertmaster David Kim will tell us about performance reimagined during the time of COVID. To start, we focus on one of the most watched congressional races in the nation, New Jersey's 2nd District, currently held by Republican Congressman Jeff Van Drew. Most of us know this story. Van Drew was elected to the seat as a Democrat, but switched his party affiliation late last year, pledging undying support for President Trump. Suffice it to say, New Jersey Democrats were incensed. The Republican Van Drew is now up for re-election, and Democrat Amy Kennedy is his main opponent November 3rd. She is a member of the Kennedy family by marriage, and we're now going to delve into the overall race for the 2nd District with Allison Steele, reporter for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Hi, Allison.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Of course. Let's begin with a quick look at the 2nd District. Geographically, it is the largest congressional district in New Jersey. And Allison, fair to call it purple politically?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's definitely a real political battleground. It was held by a Republican for 20 some years before Jeff Van Drew was elected. Went twice for Obama, but then went for Trump. About a third, more than a third, I believe, of the registered voters are not affiliated with either party. So absolutely right. It's deep purple.
Jeff Van Drew served in state government as a Democrat for a long time, Allison. But for many observers, his switch to the GOP wasn't a big surprise. He's pretty conservative, isn't he?
Correct. He was always known as a conservative Democrat. He was known as a pro-gun Democrat, largely. And he had taken some heat from some people over the years regarding his contributions from the NRA and his views on guns. That's absolutely right. He was always known as a conservative Democrat. And the representative, the congressman who held that seat prior to him was known as a moderate Republican.
Yeah, Frank Lobiondo. As you write, he helped the Democrats flip the House in 2018, and later his defection infuriated members of his party. Tell us about that.
This was something that obviously... correct. I mean, I think infuriated is the right word. This was not something that I covered myself, but just speaking from the work that some of my colleagues have done, this was, as much as it may not have been seen as a surprise in a way, this came after he voted against impeachment, which for some people, obviously, which for many people was a very heated issue. And after that vote, it sort of began to be seen as somewhat inevitable that he would switch parties.
I think he was one of two Democrats in the House who voted against impeachment. Let's get to Democrat Amy Kennedy. She's hoping to make Van Drew's term in office a one and done, so to speak. And again, she is a member of the Kennedy political dynasty by marriage. Tell us more about this.
So she is correct. She's married to Patrick Kennedy and has lived in Atlantic County for her entire life. Her family, she comes from a long line of Atlantic County residents, and her father was active in local government, was a freeholder and a local councilman. Grandparents used to own a bakery in Atlantic City, all kinds of local roots there. A lot of people, I think, maybe didn't really know who she was prior to this, and obviously the Kennedy name does not mean here what it means in New England.
Really?
I think so. Yeah. Just from sort of the people that I talked to on the ground about this. However, that said, it certainly does help you when it comes to fundraising, when it comes to sort of getting the infrastructure in a campaign to really help you mount a very organized effort.
Sure. But is she perhaps better known locally for her family's deep community roots? What are you hearing
That's certainly what people say to me. So people in Atlantic County certainly know who she is. They know who her family is. They know who her father is, that kind of thing.
Amy Kennedy is a mom and an educator. Give us more of a sense of who she is and the work she does.
She was a public school teacher for a long time, I think around 10 years or so. And she now works for the Kennedy Forum, which is a foundation that was founded by her husband. And she advocates for mental health and education.
How did she meet Patrick Kennedy? Do you have that information?
This is an interesting story that I guess was written about quite a bit at the time, but I was not aware of it prior to covering this race. He came down to Atlantic City to speak at a convention that had to do with mental health, some sort of fundraising event. She met him there because I gather that her father was involved with the group, and either he couldn't be there or she just went anyway. And they met there and I guess just had a very strong connection. And some time later, he moved to the Jersey Shore. He had already decided not to run for office again. So he moved to the Jersey Shore. They live in Brigantine. They have four kids together. She has another child from a previous marriage. But that's what happened.
Okay. And, you know, as mentioned earlier on, you know, the second district is absolutely humongous. And Amy Kennedy is out and about on the campaign trail. She is, at least the photographs I've seen, she's wearing a mask. Where is she on the issues, Allison?
She has taken a lot of, she's sort of hewing very close to the Democratic message that you see elsewhere. She talks to voters a lot about the economy, about the importance of supporting small businesses, talks to voters a lot about schools, obviously, in New Jersey. Schools everywhere are very important, obviously. You know, people who live in New Jersey are very proud of their public schools, and this is something that she talks to voters about quite a bit. I did not see her raise Jeff Van Drew a lot, or really at all, in the time that I spent with her on the campaign trail, but it's something that voters bring up all the time to her.
Oh, really? Have you been privy to any of those conversations?
Absolutely. There are a lot of people who say, oh, yes, I'm supporting her because I could never vote for... I talked to several people who said, I'm a Democrat. I can't vote for Jeff Van Drew. I voted for him before, but I'm done. Yeah. And it creates kind of an interesting situation for her because, you know, obviously she will take those voters. But, you know, you get the sense that she wants to try to distinguish herself separate from that.
She was not the first choice of the South Jersey Democratic political machine.
That's correct. That's correct. They endorsed a different candidate in the primary.
Bridget Harrison. Yeah. What happened there? Do you know?
What happened with regard to why they didn't support her?
I'm just curious.
That I don't know. That I did not cover that that part of the race, and so I wouldn't want to speculate about what the reasons for that were. They certainly, you know, support her now.
Yeah.
They say they want her to win. They want her to beat Jeff Van Drew.
Sure.
But I gather, don't want to speculate, but I gather that they were backing the candidate that they thought had the best chance to win against Jeff Van Drew.
So the Kennedy name has given her, I guess, a definite financial edge in her bid to win the second district?
Yes, I think that's safe to say.
Well, you know, her campaign, as you report, I think has spent at last count over $750,000 on TV ads. And I know I've seen those ads way more than I've seen anything for Jeff Van Drew. And Van Drew perhaps has spent about $100,000. You may not have this information at your fingertips, Allison, but do you know why there is such a disparity? I mean, he's not cash poor, correct?
Correct. He's got a lot of money, and he's got plenty of money. I don't know. I don't know the answer to that. I know he has some ads on Facebook. I know he's out on the trail. He's been meeting with voters and making appearances the same way that she has. I'm really not sure. I'm not sure if this is something that we can expect to change before the election. I'm not sure if maybe he feels he doesn't need them. I don't know.
Yeah, interesting. Is there any indication that he's receiving much support from the national GOP?
I can't. That's a little bit above my pay grade. I haven't. It's not something that I've seen, but that doesn't mean it's not coming. We also don't know how this race is really going yet because there haven't been any significant polls that I have been made aware of. I know that the Democrats have done some internal polls that they say show that Amy Kennedy is ahead, but I think it's hard to say.
Okay. Well, his as you do write, his campaign is taking aim at money earned by Amy Kennedy from the Kennedy Forum. What is the campaign's claim?
This is something that has that actually came up in the primary as well, with some of her other Democratic opponents. There's been some criticism against her and her husband for earning quite a bit of money from this nonprofit that he founded. And one of those allegations is that this company has taken money from drug companies and drug treatment. And I certainly couldn't speak to how much of that is, you know, makes up their budget for this for this nonprofit. That's so I gather that this is a nonprofit that takes funding from a variety of sources, and they work with a number of stakeholders to talk about mental health issues and treatment for all kinds of problems like this. So this is something that they've hit a few times on, and Amy Kennedy's response has always been that she's proud of the work that they have done. I think most recently her response to this was that she found it disappointing that Van Drew's campaign was trying to take their advocacy and give a negative slant to it.
As a member of the Kennedy family, she does have connections in high places as far as folks who are willing to help her out on the campaign trail. Martin Luther King III joined her at a rally, she's, I guess, protesting outside President Trump's rally in Wildwood for Jeff Van Drew, right?
That's right. Yeah. And President Obama endorsed her as well, which is something that not every person who runs for office for the first time gets.
At the same time, Amy Kennedy is positioning herself as a political outsider. Do I have that right?
Somewhat. It is her winning the primary despite not having been endorsed by the Democratic establishment there sort of allowed her to frame it that way, that she sort of was kind of came from behind in this, because typically they do win. They do win their races. They do the Democrats in South Jersey. A lot of their candidates do win. Yeah. So I think that has made her able to sort of say, I'm independent in a way.
And I think at the same time, though, as you mentioned at the top of this segment, I think you said there was, 30% of voters in the second district are undecided.
More than that. I don't know if undecided, but they're not registered with either party.
Okay, so we don't know where they stand, and so it could make for an interesting election night. And the week after election night as votes are counted.
Correct.
Yeah. All right. Well, Allison Steele, it was great having you with us to bring us up to speed on this race for the 2nd District. We'll find out in a few weeks what happens there. Allison Steele is a reporter for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much.
Okay. Up next, we'll speak with community activist John Di Harrell. We'll talk about the young dirt bike and ATV riders in the city. There are public safety concerns, but an ATV park might be the answer. What do you think? If you'd like to join the conversation, 888-477-9499, or you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Stay tuned.
You're supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Listening to the Regional Roundup on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Their stunts are death-defying, spectacular, hair-raising, and often dangerous. And the complaints about groups of ATV and dirt bike riders who frequently roar down Philadelphia streets have been ongoing for years. It's illegal to ride ATVs and dirt bikes on city streets, though Philly police don't give chase because of the risk of causing an accident. They do, however, issue citations and confiscate vehicles and have pulled several hundred off the street this year alone. And as the rioting seems to have escalated in recent months, City Council is once again trying to figure out a permanent compromise for riders and irate citizens. One idea that's been around for a while is a park constructed especially for ATV riders, and it is being given yet another look. Again, the lines are open, 888-477-9499. Send us an email to radiotimes@whyy.org or tweet us at WHYY Radio Times if you'd like to join the conversation. John Dye Harrell has written on this issue for WHYY's Plant Philly. He is a community activist and executive director of the Center for Returning Citizens. And he joins us now to weigh in. Welcome back, John Dye.
How are you doing? So
I'm well. You know what? I'm not so sure we have a great Skype connection. Let's see if we can chat for a moment or two to see if we might have to call you back. You there with us? Okay. I think what we're going to do is call John Dye back on a phone line and then dig into this issue, which is one that is talked about with some passion in the city of Philadelphia. Pro and con, ATVs and dirt bikes can be spectacular to watch. But if you're driving while these guys are performing around you, it can definitely be a white knuckle experience. There is risk. People have gotten hurt. Some riders have actually gotten killed in this sort of activity over the years. So what's the answer? Is it a park constructed specifically for ATV riders? So I understand that John Dye Harrell is with us now on a phone line. How you doing, John Dye?
I'm doing very well, Marty. How about you?
Oh, good. And it's Mary. So let's dig. That's no problem. That happens all the time, by the way. So let's dig into the ATV culture, which is primarily about young men who are attracted to the skill and the thrill of riding. Tell us more, John Dye.
So it's about the gymnastics, the riding, the skill. It's hip hop culture. It's young guys who are having an incredibly good time. And in terms of breaking traffic laws, yes, they do that. Yes, they are a serious concern to a lot of residents because they have incredible sound systems. And at 1 o'clock in the morning, if you hear them going by and you have children, it's disturbing. But it's a culture that's not going anywhere. And it's extremely important for the city to be able to resolve the conflict between the riders and the residents, and to create a space where their culture can grow and thrive and not impact the public and the city.
Well, tell us why this culture is so important. I think at one point in the article, you had said that this sort of activity can actually help resolve a number of public health crises.
Yes, gun violence in the city of Philadelphia is a all-time high. Creating a park that would give ATV and dirt bike riders a space to practice their craft, get them off the street, bring them to a space where they can interact, build better relations between groups from across the city, and actually reduce gun violence. We're always talking about how can we end gun violence? How can we create a better pattern of behavior for young people? And it's not about criminalizing their behavior. It's about giving them space so that what they're already doing can flourish, and understanding who they are and why they do what they do, and foster a community space where they can function and not be bothered by the police and not bother the community.
So let's talk about what is actually happening right now. Philly police don't chase riders. Again, they want to avoid accidents. They do confiscate vehicles, give tickets. In your article, you say this is the wrong approach. Tell us more about that.
It's definitely the wrong approach. You know, what you're saying to young people is we are going to criminalize your behavior. We're going to surround gas stations while you're gassing up. We're going to confiscate your vehicles. We're going to give you onerous fines, and we're going to make you a public enemy. Instead of saying, how can we create a space where this incredible bike culture can flourish? How can we bring in corporate sponsors and have weekly events? How can we create a stop the violence movement based on what the kids want to do, not what city council or the mayor or adults say, but give them a space where they can enjoy themselves, where they can come, where they can get to know each other? I mean, there's a lot of problems that you have to resolve. How do you get the kids from their homes to the dirt bike parks? That's why what I'm proposing is two dirt bike parks. One in the Port Richmond area. I just had a meeting this morning with Joe Hornstein, who's the state rep for the 177th district, and I have a call later on in the day with some city council members who are extremely interested in this.
Mm-hmm.
I said we need a park in Port Richmond that would serve the Fishtown, Port Richmond, Northeast, South Philly kids, and then a park in Fairmount Park in between West Philly and North Philly that would serve Germantown, Uptown, North Philly, West End, South Philly. And between these two parks, you literally get thousands of kids off the street, and you create an incredible atmosphere for change in the city of Philadelphia.
So John Dye, what was the sense that you got from State Representative Hornstein?
Listen, he is extremely responsive to this issue. I sat down with him and DJ Lynn Alvarez, who's a community leader. And this Friday, we're actually going to tour some of the places, you know, where the kids gather in Port Richmond and talk to individual groups. I'm going to reach out to the best young hip-hop artists in the city of Philadelphia and get them involved, because that's the music they listen to. Those are the folks they respect. And try to draw together not just community buy-in from the politicians. It has to be the police. It has to be community members. And it has to be the young folks themselves, so that if we can create these parks, they'll respect the neighborhoods, you know, to keep the music down, drive to the park, stop breaking traffic laws, and respect and honor what we're trying to do for them.
What sort of support are you seeing for this so far from Philadelphia City Council?
So far, I have had some. I'm meeting with the Kinder Books by phone later on this afternoon. Helen Gim has expressed interest. Curtis Jones, Kenyatta Johnson have for a long time talked about this issue. It's going to be very important to get Mark Scuilla and Bobby Heenan on board, because the initial park would be in their area.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that the momentum is there. We just have to push it on a citywide level. This would solve so many problems, and it would set a tone for the rest of the country. This is not just a problem in Philly. A lot of major cities have this problem.
So you see this idea proliferating. We're speaking with John Dye Harrell, who's founder and executive director of the Center for Returning Citizens. He's also a community activist. And John Dye, no surprise, we're getting a bunch of comments, calls and comments here on this issue. So let's get to some of them quickly before we move on to a little bit more about this proposed ATV park. We've got John in Lancaster says none of the motorbikes has registration. They're very talented, but it is a hazard for everyone on the street. If this becomes formalized, if this activity goes to a park or even two parks, do you see that this is changing, that kids will have to register their vehicles, pay to register them? What are you seeing there?
So we need to start a fund to help kids to register their bikes. In the suburbs, a lot of kids have parents who can afford pickup trucks, trailers. You know, our kids can't afford that. You know, we need to create a means for them to get to the parks, which means registering their bikes. So we have to get buy-in from the kids that if we do this, they're going to honor and respect.
Caller. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
And that's extremely important, because we could create a park and kids say, I like riding on the street. That's why you have to get buy-in from leaders in the group, hip-hop people, celebrities. We could create weekend tournaments where the kids could come and compete, bring in corporate sponsors so they can make money. Turn this into a industry.
All right, so Nicholas in South Philly. I'm sorry for jumping in. Nicholas in South Philly says he thinks creating a park is a good idea, although he's not sure it will solve the problem because the kids are doing criminal activity. What is your response to that?
What is criminal activity? These kids are not committing robberies. They aren't shooting each other. They're doing something that they love. We have to stop criminalizing their behavior and find a way to support it. And we have to get them in on the conversation.
Comment from Kate. She says, these are super young athletes who definitely need a place to practice. It's like snowboarding, skateboarding, and sports like that. We should applaud them. Then on the flip side, we've got John in West Philadelphia who says, don't build a park for them. These kids are intentionally out there to cause trouble, to be countercultural, to be rebellious, but they don't even know what they are being rebellious against. Any thoughts before we move on those comments, John Dye?
So we educate them, we help them, we bring them together and start having the real conversations that kids are having among themselves. Kids see us as the adversaries, old folks who want to hold them down. We got to stop being that. We have to be people they can believe in and support. And they have singular skills. If you watch some of these kids, they're incredible athletes. They do what they do. Let's support it, not criminalize it.
So if an ATV park does happen, John Dye, it wouldn't be up and running tomorrow. How do we keep people safe in the meantime?
Well, I think the very fact that we are having this conversation and we go out and we talk to the kids and tell them what we're proposing, maybe we can get some of them to scale back their activities in anticipation of what can be. Give them something to believe in. You know, show them that we're trying to work with them to create something, and wintertime is coming. You know, this activity is going to slow down over the winter, and that gives us time to put things in place so when it becomes spring again and the season really starts, we're ready for whatever they want to do.
Thomas, we've got a caller. Thomas, I guess he's from the Philadelphia area. Let's go to that line and see what Thomas has to say. Oh, okay.
Hey, Thomas.
Okay, I'm misreading our screen here. Sorry about that. Thomas is asking, what happens with the accidents, et cetera? Who is liable for injuries?
So the city is going to have to, you know, buy insurance policies for the park. You know, this is going to take a major investment, buying from the police department, from Danielle on down, but it's something that's necessary. If we don't do this, the problem is just going to grow. There's going to be more accidents. There's going to be more conflicts between the riders and the neighborhoods, and it's going to get ugly. Let's put something progressive and constructive in place before that happens.
Have you spoken with Police Commissioner Danielle Outlaw, John Dye?
She's on my list.
Okay. The pandemic has done a number on Philadelphia's budget. I mean, if the money is not there for a park, and it might well not be in these emergency times, do you see it possibly coming from elsewhere?
Yes, we need to get corporations. We need to get hip-hop artists. We need to get the Eagles, Sixers, athletes. We need to bring together as many folks as possible who have the vision to make this happen. Meek Mills, Gilly the Kid, there are hip-hop artists. There's a whole rack of young hip-hop artists that are up and coming. If you go on YouTube and you type in top 10 Philly rap artists, listen, I've been listening to these guys. They are absolutely incredible. They have crews and influence, and they're from every section of the city. Every up-and-coming hip-hop artist in the city of Philadelphia should be on board with this. They contribute money, make it happen for the kids who love your music and the kids who are from your community.
There's a lot of passion, obviously, John Dye, about this issue. Becky says, why are these riders allowed to ride through events at Fairmount Park, terrorizing kids? Every Sunday, they'll come and start riding through our cross-country meets where over 200 elementary school kids are running at Belmont Plateau. And when confronted by parents trying to keep the kids safe, they've pulled guns on us. Please build them their own parks and fine them for disrupting other parks and events. A lot of unease, and different groups of people seem to be pitted against each other.
Yes, there is. And that's why a park where not only their behavior could be regulated, but they feel at home. Yes, right now there are all sorts of things that are happening within the city that we don't want to see happening. That's because the kids feel like they don't have anything to lose. Give them a park that they would honor and respect and they can call their own, and you would see a drastic drop in the counterculture activities that we're currently seeing.
We've got just enough time to get a quick comment from Rick, who is on the line. Rick, welcome to the Regional Roundup. Do we have Rick?
Yes, ma'am.
Hi, we've only got about 20 seconds, so what's your comment?
Okay, I'll make it quick.
Okay.
Oh, you want a comment? You don't want me to talk on air. Okay.
What?
Comment is, our group is called STOP, stands for Safe Travel in our Philadelphia. There's a mass of people involved now, and as I don't know if you mentioned the change.org petition, 2,400 signatures so far. Big hearing October 7th about this whole issue, including the park. We do not oppose the park. However, we are pushing for increased enforcement, community intervention.
So, Rick, you think apparently the park is a good idea. I don't know if we still have Rick with us. Okay, we do not have Rick with us. Again, John Dye, some people are saying park's a good idea, but there are still things that need to be ironed out in the meantime. We've only got about 30 seconds left. Let's get your thoughts here.
There are so many things that need to be ironed out. And that's where specifically going out, talking to the leaders of the groups. Joe and I are going out this weekend. This is a passion of mine because I know a lot of young kids who really love this sport and they want to see it happen. It's going to take buy-in from the community, from the city, from the citizens and the neighborhood groups. I honor and respect every name on that petition, and I'm aware of what they're doing. We have to get them on board.
John Dye, unfortunately, yes. I think we've got what you're trying to say, and we were out of time, unfortunately. John Dye Harrell, thank you so much for joining us. Welcome back to the Regional Roundup.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. The Philadelphia Orchestra's fall season opens on Wednesday, and it will be entirely online, offering performances that are said to be reimagined and filmed without audiences at the Mann Center and the Kimmel Center's Verizon Hall. So what can fans and patrons expect? How has COVID-19 changed the way musicians perform together and relate to each other while performing? And has the sound of the orchestra of necessity been reconfigured, reimagined as well? Lines are open if you've got questions or comments. 888-477-9499 is the number to call. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times or send an email to radiotimes@whyy.org. For the rest of the hour, we'll be speaking with Orchestra President and CEO Matthias Tornopolsky. Matthias, a pleasure to have you with us.
How are you?
And we'll have David Kim, the Philadelphia Orchestra's concertmaster, with us in just a little bit. So Matthias, let's get started with how the orchestra has been changing things up during the pandemic. I think we're in our seventh month now of life lived with COVID-19. Characterize what this last half year has been like for the orchestra, the challenges and even the emotions.
The last time the orchestra convened was on March 12th in front of an empty Verizon Hall. We decided to go ahead with that concert, but we had to let the audience know not to come. And it was beautiful performances of Beethoven's Fifth and Sixth Symphonies and the new work by a young composer, Iman Habibi. We partnered with WHYY to get that concert broadcast and streamed live on our platforms. At the end, when our music director, Yannick Nezesinger, and the musicians stood to take a bow at the end of the performance, it was a moment of extraordinary power. I've never experienced anything like that. I don't think anyone who saw it in person or online, the musicians on the stage especially, knew what, felt the gravity of the moment, but couldn't understand what it was. And that launched a journey that we are still on. We decided right away that while we couldn't convene the orchestra in person, that we would do so online and in the community in whatever way was safe to do so. And we decided then months later that we would still launch our 2021 season, Our World Now. We've not been able to perform dozens and dozens of concerts in front of audiences at home in Philadelphia, at our summer homes in Vail and Saratoga and the Mann Center for the Performing Arts. But we partnered with the Mann in the summer to do a pilot on August 6th. That was the first time the orchestra got back together, a small group, about 25 musicians. Mm-hmm. And that gave us the confidence to say, okay, we're going to go forward. We're going to create an online season on our digital stage, but we're going to create special concerts just for this new season. And that's what we've been doing this week, and the results will be launched on Wednesday.
All right, we'll talk a little bit more about that in a moment, but I'd like to bring David Kim into the conversation, the Philadelphia Orchestra's concert master. Welcome, David.
Thanks, Mary.
So briefly, just really briefly, remind us of the role of concert master, which you've held for at least 20 years, and what has had to change or even fall by the wayside for you in your work?
Well, the concertmaster is the first chair of the violin section and kind of the quarterback of the orchestra. And the concertmaster serves as one of the public faces of the orchestra in the press and media, and also as kind of a liaison between the conductor, who is the unquestioned leader of the orchestra, and the rest of the membership, whether that is verbally or kind of leading by example. And so that's what the concertmaster does. And in terms of how things have changed, well, first and foremost is just not being able to perform live before an audience in a concert hall, whether that be in, you know, Colorado or in upstate New York at the Mann Center. And so
what changes for you if you can't perform live as a performer? What is the difference in feeling during the performance?
Well, that visceral kind of, you know, even though we're looking at the music, we're looking at the conductor, we're closing our eyes, we're involved, there's something that we sense directly from the audience. And especially with an orchestra like the Great Philadelphia Orchestra, you feel the adoration, you feel the affection, the warmth, the lifetime of memories. You just feel all that coming through. And when you don't have that, it's been a period of adjustment. But you know what? We're still doing it. And, you know, all this online material that we're creating is no less meaningful.
Matthias, let's talk about safety protocols for musicians and staff at the orchestra. How have things changed there? We know that obviously there's no live audience. And if you take a look at the orchestra performing as it does now, there are many fewer musicians on stage and everybody is spaced fairly far apart from each other.
Exactly. Safety is the top priority. So we decided, and there are many layers of safety protocols that we put in place. So here are some of them. We're performing outside at the Mann Center for the Performing Arts, which is currently safer than being in an indoor venue like our beloved Kimmel Center. So we're outside. The musicians. The musicians are indeed spaced at minimum 6 feet apart. I think there's 10 feet between the conductor and the musicians. Wind players are surrounded by plexiglass shields, also at a distance from their colleagues. The rear door to the stage of the Mann Center for the Performing Arts stage is open so that there's airflow. The recording services of the orchestra last 90 minutes rather than the usual 2 or 2.5 hours, just to sort of limit the amount of time on stage. And then we take a long break to enable the crews to really clean very well. There's no backstage dressing room area used. There are tables set out in the audience, so every musician has their own space. So there are layers and layers of protocols. Those are just some of them, just to make sure everyone is incredibly safe. It, of course, creates some challenges as well for the musicians performing on stage because they're used to being close together sharing the music sound.
Yeah, I was wondering, David Kim, I mean, if you're 6 feet apart, how have you had to reconfigure the way you play and relate to your fellow musicians?
Well, there are two main ways that we kind of stay connected when we're on stage. And one is visually, and of course, the most important is by listening. And so we have to calibrate now when we're on stage and so separated. And so some folks are really far apart. We have to recalibrate how we listen and adjust to one another. And I'd say we're relying much more on visual cues. And we're just making sure we are with the stick, the baton of Yannick Nézet-Séguin. And because if we listen, sometimes it's not a true reaction because there's this huge distance and there are plexiglass shields and there's wind and there's outdoor ambient noise, and so we are really playing with eyes up all the time.
Yeah. I gather, though, with all this, Matthias Tarnopolsky, you're going to say that you're excited about opening night on Wednesday.
Of course I'm excited about opening night on Wednesday.
Tell us about the 7 o'clock shout. Tell us about that piece.
So 7 o'clock shout was the orchestra's first COVID commission. We asked Valerie Coleman, who's a composer that we have worked with before and adore, to write a piece for the moment, a piece that the orchestra could play from home, which is exactly what they did. We commissioned her, I think, in March or April. And 7 o'clock shout is a tribute to the frontline healthcare and other workers who are at the beginning of the battle with COVID, who would be applauded at 7 o'clock when there were changes in shifts in hospitals, for example. And so that is a tribute to them, but it's much more than that. It is also a piece that has turned into something of an anthem for the orchestra. So the musicians of the orchestra performed this, recording their parts from home when they did it in June. And now, for the first time, they have been able to play it together. So this is really the first live performance of Valerie Coleman's 7 o'clock shout. It's a pageant of a piece. It is a valedictory piece, and it is just a gorgeous piece of music, and we're incredibly grateful to Valerie for writing with such love for the Philadelphia Orchestra.
And we'll hear just a sample of that as we head toward the close of the show. But first, let's get to caller Aaron in Kensington is with us now on the Regional Roundup. Hi, Aaron.
Hi there.
How are you, and what is your question or comment?
My comment really is regarding what at least I perceive as a sort of persistent ethnocentrism to the orchestral program in general. I'm not singling out the Philadelphia Orchestra per se, but I think there just needs to be a greater awareness and inclusion of composers of American origin and, frankly, of more diverse backgrounds. I think that the institution of the orchestra needs to develop alongside culture in a sort of a parallel state of growth.
All right, Aaron, thank you for that. Let's send that to you, Matthias Tarnopolsky. Inclusivity and the orchestra, and where is the orchestra with this?
Aaron's right. Diversity is excellence. Excellence is diversity. And the Philadelphia Orchestra is on a journey to ensure that we become a more diverse and inclusive organization. I'm going to read you the names of some of the composers that are involved just in this digital stage fall season. Our composer in residence, Gabriella Lena Frank, Valerie Coleman, Vivian Hunt, Vivian Fung, Jessica Hunt, Mizzy Mazzoli, Jesse Montgomery, and Carlos Simon, who come from a wide variety of backgrounds and origins. The commitment of the Philadelphia Orchestra to be as diverse, equitable, accessible, and inclusive as we can be, is deeply felt and a real commitment. And I hope Aaron will see the evolution in the orchestra, certainly in the last year and going forward as well. And it's there to be seen on our digital stage, but there is a lot of work to do and a long road on this journey still to go.
There have been some retirements this year, among them violinist Booker Rowe, who was with the orchestra for at least 50 years. Mr. Rowe is Black, and I believe there are three Black members as of this time. What does the, if you will, the recruitment process look like?
The recruitment process for musicians in the orchestra is one that hasn't changed very much. And I know it's something that the musicians and Yannick and all of us in the Philadelphia Orchestra family want to make sure that we are as accessible an organization that we can be. So our recruitment process needs to be one that ensures the, first of all, the warmest welcome to anyone who wants to audition for the orchestra, and that it casts as wide a net as possible. So we need to make sure that the systems that we have in place, and these are largely administrative and audition systems that we have in place, that they are finding the widest range of talent that's out there. And that wide range of talent is diverse talent. And that's our commitment for the future.
David Kim, this next question. Oh, go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, and I just wanted to note Booker's retirement from the Philadelphia Orchestra. I mean, this is after a distinguished, you know, 5-year career, we're going to miss Booker enormously. You know, my daughter and his granddaughter sing in the same choir, so I always used to enjoy seeing him at the choir concerts. There's a beautiful blog post about him on our website by Dr. Patsy Baxter Rowe, his wife, Booker's wife, about his history with the orchestra, and we'll miss Booker greatly. He is an icon in the orchestra.
Well, let's get back to the performance that happens on Wednesday. David Kim, how do you? It's online, of course. How do you recommend viewing at home? Lights dimmed, as if you were there during the performance. A beverage in hand, perhaps. Casual dress, dressed up. What are your thoughts, David?
Well, normally opening night is pretty glitzy and fun and exciting to be there, but I would recommend that everybody put on their favorite PJs or sweats, grab a drink, whether it's a hot mug of tea or a nice glass of Cabernet, and whether it's on your computer or your iPad, there are no rules. Just tuning in and being a part of the evening means so much to the orchestra, the community, the arts world, as the Philadelphia Orchestra is a leader, and it's going to be fantastic. We had a blast recording everything, and you know, it's just the new normal for the moment. Yeah. And to see all of us on stage with masks on, playing Yannick with a mask on, and yet the music making is just as spectacular and as meaningful as it always has been. So I just ask everybody to tune in, tell their friends and relatives to tune in. And it's so affordable and accessible, and you're just going to love it. The repertoire is terrific as well.
Matthias, in about 20 seconds, will you be able to watch as a member of the audience, or will you be taking notes?
I'm going to watch as a member of the audience. I mean, I'm part of the hosting group. Just to everyone listening, this is your orchestra. We are here for you. We are making music. It's really one of the jewels in Philadelphia's crown, and we're just delighted to be back together sharing this gorgeous music. And great to hear from you, David, too.
And this note, too, WHYY has the rights to air some of the concerts after they have streamed to the orchestra membership. And WHYY will let everybody know when those are available. So listen, best of luck with the upcoming season. It's been great speaking with you, Orchestra President and CEO Matthias Tarnopolsky. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Mary.
And Concertmaster David Kim. So nice to have you with us.
Pleasure. Thanks, Mary.
All right. We're going to close with Valerie Coleman's, just a bit of Valerie Coleman's 7 o'clock shout, performed by the Philadelphia Orchestra. As always, we invite you to join us on social media at whyy.org/radiotimes. Diana Martinez is our engineer. Our producer is John Ahrens. And I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Thank you for joining us. Be well.